Hi, and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. I'm joined today by Lucy Caldwell. Lucy Caldwell is the award-winning author of three novels, plays, and radio dramas, and two collections of short stories. Her most recent novel, These Days, was published by Faber in March 2022. She has received the Rooney Prize and the Susan Smith Blackburn Award, amongst others. She is going to read from Neve Pryor's story, Peter and Jane.
Thanks, Nicole. Peter and Jane. Jane. I am Jane. I work in a room with other girls at tables. We take letters that others write by hand in pencil or pen, and we put them in ink using a man-made writer. This is what I trained to do after school. I am good at it. I was always very good at school and always did my homework. Sometimes I long for home, but not home as it is now. Home back then. Back when it was nice. When the sun was always out and we could play all day out of doors. Before I had to be a woman. But a girl must become a woman and a boy has to become a man. I live a long way from my old home now. Peter lives away too, in another place with many streets. Too many streets to know them all. Peter. I am Peter. I am out of work. So many are out of work in this place of many streets. So many are out of work everywhere. That is how it is these days. The day the man handed me my hat, I asked why. Look, Peter, he said, many have lost their work. I don't want to let you go, but I must. There is no money coming in. That's just the way it is these days. You got on very well here. Maybe you will find something new. I did not find anything new. There is no use looking. This year, more men than before are out of work and more men by the day. I can work. I can keep books and I'm very good at it. I was the one to keep books for men who made boats. They don't make boats anymore. That shop is closed, which is why no one wants me to keep their books now. There's nothing to write in the books. There are no books to keep. When I was little, I read and always did my homework. When I was little, I was always a big help to my father at home. Now I cannot find work. Now I have nothing to do. Now I am no use. When I was little and did not know how to do something, my mother used to say to me, put your thinking cap on. But my thinking does not work very well anymore. There is no exit from the black place I am in. Jane. When I am not at work, I do it with many men. Sometimes it is fun, but not always. It is something I have to do, like drinking water or eating. I don't tell anyone how many there have been. Maybe they know a little of it, but they don't know much about my private life. I like that. I like that they don't know. Night after night, I do it with man after man. I know many may think it is not right to do this, but it makes things good. If just for that little window of time when I can stop being me, when the thinking stops, when the room in my head goes white and I forget who I am. Peter. I live in a one-room place next to the bus station. Much of the day, I am in bed. My one window, which looks down on the street where buses come and go and men sit at the station entrance drinking from bags, is so little that even daylight is like nighttime in here. At night, I sit looking at the box. I eat from cans. I am becoming round. Sometimes I go to the cafe down the street and use what little money I have to eat cake. I go there too because I would like someone to talk to me. I think the woman who owns a cafe thinks I'm a pig. I don't like to say it, but the thing is, I don't know anyone here. The work I did in a room on my own. Sometimes I go for many days without talking. It is just me on my own, day after day. Mummy used to write to me. Now I do not get letters from anyone. I have not got any letters in over a year. Jane. Some time ago, I went to bed with the man I work for. At the time, I did not know if that was a good thing or not. It could be good for my work or it could be bad for it. I would have to see. On my way home after work, he pulled over in his car and said, "You were a doll. You were a sweet little thing." I could see he wanted me. We went to his house. I never take them back to my place. I like to get away before they get up in the morning. As soon as we were in his house, I asked him to take off my top. "Take me now," I said. I put my hand on his fly and said, "Give it to me good." I said that because they like it when you talk like you were a very bad girl, but I did want it good as well. He looked like all his Christmases had come at once. We did it right there in the entrance. We did fast and slow and fast. We did it like dogs. We did it all over the house. In the morning, he looked old, like a tree. He could have been someone's father's father. Come to think of it, I think he was. I saw pictures of children in the sitting room. I was about to go when he said, "How about some morning fun?" What could I do? I work for him. I sat on top of him and seesawed. Soon he said, "Go slow. I don't want to come right now." But I went fast so he would. When he came, he said, "Yes, who's your daddy? Who's your daddy?" As I got my things to go, he said to me, "You know, I did not know if you would be any good in bed, but you are one of the best I've had. You are some girl. And I would know. I've been with many birds in my time, so many birds. Are you going to thank me for the good time?" "Thank you," I said. "Thank you what?" "Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good girl. Let's do this again sometime. Not if I can help it," I did think.
Thank you, Lucy. That was really great. That's a great to read. Just talk to me for a minute about why you chose this particular story.
I chose this story. This story, it has a very, very interesting conceit, but I think it's one of those stories that does what all great stories do, which is it somehow manages to become so much larger than the sum of its parts. So this story, Neve Pryor, the premise is very, very interesting. She uses the Peter and Jane books, which I grew up learning to read. I was writing one of the last years that they used the Peter and Jane books in school. And she says that the Peter and Jane books, which were the Ladybird keyword reading series, they use 300 keywords. Those are all the words that they use. And so she decided to write a story seeing what Peter and Jane would look like grown up, but she only allowed herself to use these words. She had kind of strict rules that she allowed herself to, say, add an S to a verb to make it plural. She allowed herself to use, ED. She had to use nouns as verbs. She had to sort of do some kind of clever things, but she was quite strict with it. And she says that in this keyword world, what's interesting is not just the words that exist in it, but the words that don't. And she says the only emotion is love. There's no happy, there's no sad. There's black, white, blue, green, red. That's it. There are no other colours. Numbers are limited from 1 to 5. There are man and woman, but there are men, no woman. And so she starts to see the limitations of this world. And I think it's really interesting, this sense of this childhood world. But she's using these words to discuss very adult themes. And as you can tell just from the excerpt that I read, you know, there's depression, there's hopelessness, there's sex, there's joblessness. So the story becomes political, it becomes grown up, it becomes all of these really interesting things. And I think what I love about it is how it uses one of the things I sometimes do with writers, especially if I'm working with beginner writers, is you work with the short story particularly as the art of limitation. You know, in the short story, everything, your word count is limited, maybe the amount of characters you can have is limited, your time is limited. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to work out how much of the reader can you bring to the story. You know, how much can a good short story that has to be more than the sum of its parts resonate with something that already exists with the reader. And, you know, you think of the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. That's very effective because we're bringing it's maybe unexpected that Jesus would show emotion in this way, that weeping is a sign of helplessness. You know, Jesus wept. And a student of mine wrote a story once that was very clever, and it was Trump wept. Yeah. And so, you know, what he was doing in that is bringing everything we know, and this story was written at a particular moment in time a couple of years ago, but it was bringing everything that we know of that character and how that character is publicly, and using that to bring something unexpected. And I think there's something similar going on here with Peter and Jane. I think there are so many interesting things going on, but that's one of the first things, I think.
I didn't actually notice until I got to the end and her explanation. I didn't realize it was based on the Peter and Jane books, embarrassingly. One thing I did feel when I read this was a profound sense of jealousy, because I haven't finished a story in a long time. And I feel that this has like such a great, clear structure. Like every paragraph ends so well on things that I was like extremely impressed. It has a sort of fairy tale feel as well, doesn't it? Like I feel, you know, these kids thrown into this really grown up environment. And I think that the fact that they don't lose that language is the most interesting part of it. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I love it absolutely for that. I wish, you know, it's very difficult to do a story like this. And this is a story that I wish I'd thought to do. I went back to my own, some of the other books I learned to read with growing up. They were the Puddle Lane series. And, you know, the Magician, the Green Sugar Mice, the Magic Box. I think there's something when you're a child, at least when I was a child and I first learned to read, there's that magic of feeling that you do have access to this other world. You know, there's a power of it. And I think there's something of the power of those first stories that we encounter, which are fairy tales via Disney or whatever it is, you know, Pixar. So the first stories that we encounter, they get very, very deep into the fabric of us. And the first stories that we feel able to read privately or read ourselves, there's such a power there that I think Neve Pryor is tapping into with this Peter and Jane. And I think there's something interesting going on with, you know, I was thinking about nostalgia, you know, when Jane says, sometimes I long for home, but not home as it is now, home back then. You know, that's the emotion of, you know, Van Morrison of Astral Weeks, you know, I am nothing but a stranger in this world. You know, I come from somewhere very far away. There's the Portuguese word saudade, the Welsh word hiraeth, you know, the Japanese, the mononoaware. There's this sense, so there's something very existential there about this longing to return somewhere, this longing to return to a place we can't return to. You know, that nostalgia, I think, is such an interesting emotion. The return home, the sense that we can't return home. There's a pain that we can't return home. And so there's something of that double vision of childhood and the wanting to return there. Only, of course, it's not that place that we want to return to. It's not that state. It's so that idea of wanting to go back somewhere, and that idea of being unable to, and that idea of something that is lost. You know, there's something very profound there, something of the leaving home, the leaving the Garden of Eden. All of those things are there in this story. And then I think having to describe a very adult world using only childish vocabulary is really effective. I mean, technically, it's very clever when she takes a word like come and uses it in that adult sexual sense. Yeah, you know, you think of the way the Peter and Jane words are used, and or you think of, you know, Peter's, the simplicity. It's kind of devastating where he says, there is no exit from the black place that I am in. Trying to describe an emotion, a very complex and very adult emotion in the limited ways that we have, because that's what we're always trying to do with words. You know, we're always trying to use words. In my own stories, I think of words as particular rhythms in an order to create a spell. You know, I think of them as to evoke a mood, to do something. And I think a writer is always trying to create something more than the words allow. And here in this story, I think that's done really effectively.
Yeah, and I agree. And also I think the fact that the words are so limited, like in their adult life, it just adds to the sense of helplessness. Like these forces like are so huge, so overpowering that they can't kind of be retaliated against in many ways.
And Neve Pryor, she wrote a little piece for The Stinging Fly describing the books, and she says in it, she says that these books, the Ladybird books, they accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. Everything in the world was good. And this idea that the perfect ladybird world could be on the brink of something darker set me writing. And I think that's so interesting when you think about, you know, we're now into the realms of toxic positivity or into the realms of, you know, what gets suppressed. We're kind of getting Jungian here in, you know, what's the shadow? If we accentuate how happy, how shiny their world is, what is it? At what cost? What's the cost of that? What's being suppressed? What's not being allowed? And in here, it's she allows the darkness full reign, you know, in this Peter and Jane world where the positive is accentuated, nothing negative is eliminated. We're into fairy tale territory again here. There's a fairy tale that I love that's about a king who doesn't want his child to know decay, death, disease. And so every single night when the child is asleep, the staff have to, you know, deadhead every flower that's showing signs of dying. Anyone who's aging or becoming decrepit is banished from the kingdom. And of course, what happens is the child starts to realize that they're living in this artificial realm, and they leave, they manage to sneak out because they want to discover death, they want to discover what's real, they want to discover, you know, we're kind of Truman Show as well, like all of these, you know, maybe childhood is something we all have to leave, and we all have to discover these darker things. And this story, I love the way that Peter and Jane have left their childhood, and they're ill-equipped for the adult world, because in the world of the ladybird world of Peter and Jane, they've only been allowed to know positive things. Everything has always been perfect. They've always done their homework. They've always had a smiling mother. Yeah. They've always had a happy dog. And nothing in their childhood has equipped them to deal with the adult world. And that's part of the tragedy of it as well.
Yeah, no. That fairy tale sounds incredible. I want to look it up. But also, I really, you know, thinking about what I like in a story recently, and I think this does it brilliantly, you know, there has to be like some kind of form of movement. Like, and I do think there is. Mm-hmm. And I actually found the ending of the story quite hopeful, or, you know, just rebuilding the family unit. It's not cynical, the end at all, the way they come back with their father and the brother and the sister have like a relationship again. And yeah, I was wondering what do you like in a story in that kind of way? Like, what does a story have to do for you to really and get your attention?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I think that the danger with writing a story like this is that it's static, you know, or that it's bound by, say, the narrative of a Peter and Jane book, you know, maybe something happens, order is restored.
Yeah.
You know, so, but in this story, right away, we're in there. Jane is sleeping with people and loses her job, and Peter's depressed and sees no way out, and is, although he doesn't have the word for it, he is suicidal. He doesn't want to live anymore. And then the story, there is a sort of magic to it when the movement of this story is in the direction of a sort of stubborn sort of hope. And the story takes us right into that dark place, you know, in contrast with what we would expect of the Peter and Jane. And then that's what the movement of it is. You know, for a while, Jane gets a dog and the dog dies. But then, you know, after that, Jane says towards the end, after many black days go past, I think mommy would not like us to be like this. I cannot let my father and brother live like this. What would mommy do? And then they start, one day at the dinner table, daddy says, I wish your mother were here. Peter goes red and looks down. I do too at first. And I sit up, look right at daddy and say, I know mommy was everything to us, but we must learn to be three and not four. And so from that moment, and there's very little, there's only a couple of paragraphs of the story remaining, once they have that realization that they have to start building a new world that they don't have words for, and they have to start again, really.
It's such a simple idea, like a childlike idea, you know, that you have to like help each other. But I actually found that like moving. I feel like I've read, you know, lots of stories like this in some ways, you know, lots of kind of disillusioned work stories. I've written several of them. But I feel that the movement towards hope at the end was actually very surprising, and it really changes the
Yeah, and it's a juxtaposition, isn't it, of the something very childish. With something very profound, very profound said in a very childish way. Mm. So the contrast, I think, is really interesting. You know, we get to a place. Peter and Jane have lost their innocence. They've left their childhood. They've grown up, but then the sort of I always think that there's a different sort of innocence that can only come through experience. And maybe that innocence is a sort of hopefulness or a sense of wonder or a hopefulness that is almost maybe a moral attitude to the world and maybe that's the trap of middle age, is of things ossifying and things becoming negative and preempting what your reaction is going to be to something. But here, the sort of willed movement outwards and the movement towards a sort of deliberate hope and a deliberate optimism, you know, contra everything that life has taught you. Mm. You know, maybe that's the real sort of innocence that maybe a psychoanalysis would say we have to strive for in adulthood. You know, we have to keep on looking outward and being hopeful and being open to being changed and having new experiences. Mm-hmm. I think there's something of that here as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's what makes it such a moving story to reread as well. I want to ask you, just because you read some of those sections, the sex scenes in the story, they're very dark, very brutal, and they're all kind of relayed through this kind of extremely straightforward, almost childlike, considering the story itself.
Yeah, and funny. I see Saw, you know, on top of him.
Yeah. And he's I don't really know how to write sex scenes, and I feel like she does a great job here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think one of the best writers of sex scenes would be Sarah Hall, and English short story writer, and she's brilliant. And what she says, of course, is that when you're writing sex scenes, you're never just writing the sex. You know, you're writing all the other stuff. Maybe the problem is one of vocabulary, because we have, you know, very coarse slang words, and we have very clinical words. So maybe there are certain technical problems that here are overcome because she doesn't have those words. She has to find other ways of saying it. Mm. But when you're writing sex, I think what's very clear here is you're writing power. And the childish words just accentuate that disparity between Jane and her boss. So I think that if you're looking at some of that scene that I read, and, you know, it goes on. The next time we did it in his car, because his missus was at home, he stops in a car park and I said, "Let me see your big thing. It is as big as a horse's." And I gave him head. And that, you know, that thing, it's so it feels so transgressive, because these are using the words from the Peter and Jane books. You know, she's not using any other words. So she's having to find the words in these Ladybird books for, you know, 4, 5, 6-year-olds and use them to describe these very adult things. But the way that she has to, it feels kind of coarse, and it feels transgressive, and it feels that she is, you feel the power imbalance. Where you have this young woman who's using the language of a child to describe sexual acts. It feels subversive. It feels often very funny. And it feels very unsettling as well, I think.
Really unsettling. And it also feels like both of them, both Peter and Jane in this story, are just being guided, like they would be in a story being told to go here, without, like, you know, having any impetus of their own, you know, it feels like everything is sort of outside their control, which when I think when they kind of take back control in the last few paragraphs, that's what I find so moving, that they're making decisions.
That's what's moving, and that's the only time that they have autonomy.
Yeah.
You know, Peter has no job, he's doing nothing. Jane is sleeping with men and her boss at work and nothing. And it is that the story moves towards that moment where for the first time, they do something.
Yeah.
You know, I always say, one of the things that I always ask myself of my own work, and I always ask of the students in my Faber Masterclass, is it's a way of, I ask the question, why this day? Of all the days that we could possibly have seen, why are we seeing this day? Why this moment? Hilary Mantel puts it really well. She says, concentrate the narrative energy around the moments of change. That is a slightly more sophisticated way of putting that. But if I were to ask, you know, the why this day question, this story could be very generic. But the why this day question is, on this day or on the day of this story, the change, the narrative change, is that they do take control. They do start acting. They do decide, Jane decides, that she is going to act. Mm-hmm. That things are going to be different. So she literally takes control of the narrative.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's satisfying as a story, because I think we do need very little plot for a story to be effective. My own stories worked when I stopped seeing them as prose narratives. You know, I kind of divorced them from plot. Some of my stories have a lot of plot, some have very little plot, but they do need a change. They do need a tilt. They do need a transition. And that, in this story, comes... when Jane takes control of the narrative. And that's the why this day. You know, why are we seeing, we could have seen, you know, generic years in Peter and Jane's life, and it wouldn't have been satisfying as a story. It might have been interesting as an exercise, but it wouldn't have been a story. But the thing that makes this thing a story is that something is fundamentally different at the end.
You've mentioned to me that you teach this story, and what do you think your students learn from the story, and how do you feel the general response to it is?
I'm always really intrigued. I teach online, and so I do get students from all over the world. I've had students from Mauritius, from India, from Australia, from you know, completely different cultures, different ages, and I'm always interested to know, does this story work as well for someone who hasn't grown up on the Peter and Jane books? Because I think here it's interesting. I was thinking of art, Nicole, because you're so good at art and writing art. And I think of how for most of my teens and my early 20s, I did not understand conceptual art. You know, I didn't know what it was supposed to be doing. I would go into a gallery and I kind of feel anxious because I didn't know how I was supposed to be feeling, how I was supposed to be responding. I would very diligently read, read what they said on the wall about what the piece and what it was meant to be, what it was meant to represent. Yeah. And I remember the moment that I understood conceptual art for the first time was I'd gone with a friend who was studying art to, we were sort of very early 20s, and I went with her to Munster. Documenta happens every 10 years. And this year it was in Kassel in Germany. And we went at the same time to the Munster Sculpture Fest, where artists are invited to create works for the city, many of which are permanent. And we went there to see an artwork by the great conceptual artist, Rebecca Horn, whose work I now love. And what she had done is she had taken an old sort of guardhouse that had been sealed off from you know, the Nazi times until she opened it. And it was this guardhouse where the Nazis had interned prisoners and brought them out to the courtyard to be shot. And it had been closed off until she opened it. And what she did is, you walked into this building and into the small cells. She had got these sort of sprung metal contraptions on the walls that at different rates, they were automated, so they would pull back and they would tap on the walls. And so I walked in there, I was listening to these thick brick walled cells, these tapping things, and you start to think, you start imagining you can hear Morse code, you can hear messages coming, and you start imagining that you can hear you know, prisoners tapping on the walls, and what is it that they're trying to communicate? And you think of, you know, the taps start to become you start to feel that you're in the middle of some kind of communication, is on the edge of your catching it. And then one of the other things she did is there's a well in the middle of the courtyard. And she had a two stories up. She has a container that collects the rainwater that falls from the sky. Mm. And it has one drop falls into the very center of this well. And she has it timed so that drop falls and the ripples come out, and at the moment they reach the edge of the well, another drop falls. So you've got this continuous sort of movement of these drops. And I was kind of wandering around, realizing that what being in this immersive artwork was doing for me is it was allowing, it wasn't sort of saying anything that I needed to understand, but it was allowing space for me to bring to it, you know, the times that we used to play at school, Escape from Colditz, or the stories that I'd read of prisoners of war and their last communications, or, you know, fairy tales, a courtyard where a princess, a golden ball falls and the princess goes down and gets it. So I could feel my synapses sort of firing, and I could feel this artwork allowing to bring together for me experiences of mine that I hadn't associated together in that way before I was in that space. And I realized then that good conceptual art, it's a sort of co-creation, you know, it's creating the conditions that allow you as a viewer to enter into it and to bring something of yourself into it and into communication. And so maybe there will be certain communal experiences, but also it allows... there's no one experience that is necessary. You know, it's everything that is evident about conceptual art. But it was the first time that I really felt that I understood it. And this is a very long-winded way of saying, I always wonder if some of the strength of this piece for me is knowing Peter and Jane. You know, it's doing that thing that it's having the shortcut to a sort of like a familiarity, a language of familiarity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's drawing on something of my own feelings of childhood and learning how to read and the sort of world and the time that I grew up in. And I wonder always if that makes a story even more powerful for those who have grown up with it. Why I think it's a good story, why I think the story works, is that that doesn't seem to be the case. People seem to be able to respond to this story, whether or not they know what Peter and Jane are, whether or not they grew up with Peter and Jane or not, or entirely different ways of reading.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways to read it and lots of different ways into the story, I think, as well.
Yeah, and I think it's something that's one of the things that lifts this story from interesting exercise or sort of interesting exercise into limitations, into art. Because it does create space for the reader. You know, I know Peter and Jane, so I'm bringing my own very particular experience of Peter and Jane to that. But it creates enough space for a reader who isn't familiar with that to bring something else, I think.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And another thing I really, really like about this story is how it plays with gender as well. Like, I feel like they still have... their childlike conceptions of gender. Jane says at one point, but a girl must become a woman and a boy has to become a man. And I feel like she's, you know, Niamh Pryor is like playing with what is expected of a woman and a man, and how that can kind of fall apart. And then suddenly your conception of yourself can fall apart. And it's actually very, it's very moving as well.
Yeah, and what is possible for us, you know, how we are trapped by those early narratives that we grow up with, and how we're trapped by the vocabulary we grow up in. And as she says, you know, in the Peter and Jane world, she says, though there is man and woman, there are men, but there are no women, you know, there's no woman plural. So, but there are men plural. So the characters, Peter and Jane, you feel how trapped they are between... what they're allowed to be, what they're allowed to do. And at this level, it's intensified because it's very much the vocabulary that's letting them be or not be and how constrained they are by that.
Yeah, no, it's so clever. The first time I read it, I was like, this is very good. And then I think it's on the second or third reading that you understand the number of kind of layers it's playing with. I want to ask you a little bit about your own work now, Lucy. So you've written stories and novels and plays. And I just want to know, when do you know you're writing a story, and what do you think a story can do that a play or a novel necessarily can't do?
Yeah, I think it's always, you know, we're talking about limitations here and working with limitations and how they can be such assets for a story, such interesting things to work with. I think that, well, I wrote short stories for 10 years, at least 10 years, without any of them working.
Yeah, okay.
And during that time, I had plays on, I had novels published. But my short stories, I always think there's a poem of Sylvia Plath that I love, that she looks at her poems that didn't work, and the poem is called Stillborn. Mm. And she imagines her poems that have failed to work in kind of jars, as if they're in a sort of Hunterian museum, you know, like kind of fetuses in jars. And she says, they smile and smile and smile at me, but still their lungs won't fill and their hearts won't start. And I was writing stories that sometimes it would feel that they had an interesting plot or they had interesting something. And sometimes I would feel that they were trying to breathe or there was a flicker of life, but they just didn't come alive. And what I realized that what I was doing is I was seeing stories as miniature prose narratives. And that's completely wrong. You know, a story, a short story, although it's prose, I think it has very, very little in common with a novel. And actually, it has far more in common with a play or far more in common with a poem. And I think maybe it's to do with that intensification. You know, if you're watching a play, you watch it all the way through. You watch it. It's maybe at an intensified pitch. It would be very hard to write a novel at the pitch that a short story can reach. You couldn't sustain it. It would start to seem too much. Sean O'Fraylon, I love his description of, he says a novel is like a jumbo jet, you know, it can carry a great amount of people over a vast distance. You kind of lumbers along and gets up into the air and then transports them. But a short story is like a hot air balloon. It can reach vertiginous heights, but it can carry very few. And I think there's something about the pitch and the intensity of a short story. I think there's something about the intensification of a form that's far more like a poem, far more like a play. Everything has to matter. You know, everything has to matter more. You have to, in the way that a piece of good conceptual art, it needs to be you're using everything else that the reader can bring to it. You know, you're, with a story, my own story started to work when I stopped seeing them as prose narratives. I started seeing them as spells, I thought of them, which was rhythms, words in a very precise and particular order to evoke mood. And so sometimes there might be a lot of plot, sometimes there might be very little, but the purpose is evoking this mood in the reader. And I was doing that with, you know, some of the intensity of girlhood, young womanhood, young adulthood. And that's when my stories started working for me, when I started seeing them, when I started seeing them as that. And they started coming to life then. And I think that, you know, for years of having children myself, I only wrote short stories for about 10 years. And partly that was because I was looking after my children, which was a choice. I chose to do it. I wanted to do it. But I had very, very little writing time. You know, I had maybe two mornings a week. And I found that I could hold myself psychically open for a short story to work, for a novel to work. I think it's kind of it's more banal. You just have to keep going at it every day. You can't write a novel, you know, in like 2 hours a week. But what I found is that with a short story, there's something about I had very little time and my time needed to matter. And, you know, it was kind of sleepless and it was young children and I had to really put a lot of psychic energy into keeping that short story open. And my short stories are quite short as well. And I found that I could do that, but I couldn't write a novel. And then when I did write a novel, it was during the pandemic. My children were 2 and 5. And my husband and I divided up the working day equally when we were in lockdown. And so suddenly, instead of having 2 mornings a week, I had, you know, 6 mornings a week, half a day. And so I found that I hadn't expected I would write a novel, but I found that actually I could write a novel because I was able to do that sort of slow, consistent world building work of going back to something 6 days a week. And sometimes on the seventh day, I'd be so antsy that my husband would just say, look, just go back to 1941 for a couple of hours. But there was something I understood that the pleasure of a novel then came from seeing the unfolding of consciousness over time. Because what you don't have in a short story, necessarily, there's someone like Alice Munro, you know, will do it brilliantly. But what you don't necessarily have is you don't have the luxury of extended time because you have, you're more concentrated around that moment of change or that moment of something, a revelation or realization. And so a novel, I found that that was what it did have. So I think that, to answer your question, I would never begin something not knowing what form it was ever, because I think by the time I start writing, I've thought about it so much, or my instincts are so honed by years of doing it, that I know the limitations and possibilities that I'm working with. I would know what it is that I'm doing.
No, I found what you were saying there like very interesting, because it actually leads back to another question I have for you, which is that you know Leaves, I think that's your first play. It was something, it was a play I read in college, and I loved it very much. So I just wanted to ask you, because I do think the two forms are sort of similar, playwriting and short stories. And I found when I started writing plays, and when I found moving over to stories, there was stuff that I learned that was useful. But when I went from writing stories to a novel, almost nothing useful to me. I had to relearn everything.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And in fact, I would have found that writing novels was kind of bad for my plays.
Yeah.
Because I would just be giving the characters like all these big static speeches. And I think what's so interesting is I love Chekhov. And when Chekhov is done badly, his speeches are done as prose. When Chekhov is done alive, when it's brilliant, what you're getting is you're not getting the product of thought. You're not getting some beautiful carpet like unrolled for your approval. Getting the process of thought. And so even in those great long speeches by Chekhov, why they work is that it's something provisional. It's something alive. But I found that, and very few, you know, there are very few writers of novels who manage also to write plays. It was Henry James's great downfall, you know, like great genius novelist, thought it would be easy to write a play, and it's not. And in a play, you know, you're writing, you're never writing what the, you'll know this, you're never writing what the characters are doing. You're controlling the subtexts. That are flowing underneath. And there's something, a play like a short story. I love Kevin Barry's phrase. He talks about short stories as a high wire act. And he talks about them as, you know, if the rope goes slack, then you tumble and it's all over. I think there is something of a, one thing that I love as well that a play and a short story have in common is the ambiguity, you know, in a play, you can have a character walks out from a wardrobe and has a conversation with another character. And we just accept that they might be a ghost, they might be a projection of the past self, they might be, we don't need to know in order to be emotionally involved and to understand. And in a short story, you can have a similar thing where you don't need to explain something, you know, but in a novel, you have to have this psychologically plausible explanation of the action at some point. You can defer it, but you always have to. You can't just put it off. Whereas a short story, more like a play, I think it can be both things at once. It's less earthbound. You know? Does that make sense?
Oh, no, totally. And I agree with everything you're saying. And I also think what a story and a play have in common is, like you said, that moment of change. That impulse, like the day I was a big fan of Enda Walsh in college, and someone broke down his plays for me, and I feel like they were, you know, this was incredibly useful for my own work. It's like characters that are very entrenched in their routine, and the day the routine breaks, like that's the day
the routine breaks.
Everything changes. That's, I think it influenced my own work. But what made you want to write a play at such a young age? Like, where did it come from? And Can you just talk to me about writing leaves a little bit? Just because I'm such a fan.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I love you. I don't know. You know, when I was a child, I used to get behind the sofa and pretend to be a radio. You know, I used to marshal all of my siblings and my cuddly toys into plays. I always loved doing it. I went, I remember my mum took me when I was 8 to see the Youth Lyric. They were doing the cattle raid at Cooley. And I remember the actor that played Queen Maeve had this amazing red hair. Mm. And I remember the feeling of being in the theatre. I think part of the excitement was that my sisters weren't there. It was just me. And I think that, you know, and I think that you know, we were all very close in age and we all did everything together. And I remember part of the excitement was it was this magic world that was just me and just me and my mum. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking then that I wanted to do this.
Yeah.
And I wrote plays, I put plays on in school and it was something that I always wanted to do. Yeah. And I was lucky enough at university to take some master classes with a visiting writer. He was a playwright, Chris Hannan. And he's one of his Scottish playwright, Glaswegian playwright, beautiful play, Shining Souls. And he would meet up with us. There were a couple of us that wanted to be playwrights. And he would meet up with us and he would say, you know, send me your work. So you'd give him these couple of scenes. And, you know, they would be kind of these scrappy handwritten scenes. And he would meet up with you in the Cafe Nero that was newly opened. And he smoked these rollies in licorice paper. So he'd be intensely rolling these cigarettes and smoking these rollies. And he would take your work so seriously. Mm. You know, you felt like starting out as a writer, such shame and self-consciousness and embarrassment, especially I was studying literature at the time. And I was so aware of how far my work was from the stuff that I was reading, from the stuff that I wanted it to be, how bad my scenes were compared to the plays I was reading. But what Chris Hannan did, it was the greatest, greatest gift I think that you can give a writer, is he just took it so seriously that there was no room for self-consciousness. There was no room for shame. It would have been a disservice to him to fail to rise to that and to fail to discuss your work seriously. And so that, it's just the greatest gift to discuss your work. To discuss your work seriously, to take it seriously. So he would take your scene seriously. And that kind of, it gave you permission to take them seriously as well. No matter how bad you knew they were, you were discussing them as scenes, you were discussing them in a practical sense, you were discussing how you could make them better, as if this was a shared problem. That was the greatest gift. And so, and I was writing my own first novel at the time, and I remember it's something that I think, you know, being an Irish writer, it's far more accepted that you can move between forms a lot more fluidly. And I did find in England, people would say to me time and time again, well, which are you rather? You can't be both. You know, either you're a playwright who's masquerading as a novelist, or you're trying your hands at something. You know, you can't be a jack of all trades. Which are you? And it was really striking the way that I got that again and again and again in England, in a way that I just don't think you do.
I think
in Ireland it's more accepted that you can be a writer of different forms simultaneously. You know, you can be a poet who publishes a novel, or you can be a playwright who writes a book. But you didn't. And again, when I wrote the play Leaves, I had written a play that we took up to the Edinburgh Fringe with a brilliant director, Adele Thomas, who's now a director of opera. And we took my very first play up to the Edinburgh Festival. And someone from the National Theatre happened to see it. And I mean, you know, we had audiences of like 6 people. We didn't get very many reviews. We didn't get very many, you know, we did have audiences that were at times smaller than the cast on stage. But someone saw
it. It's standard for a play.
but they saw it and they gave me, they said, would I like to be writer in residence in the National Theatre Studio? So I had 6 weeks and I got to see every single production going. Yeah. I had backstage tours of the theatre. If I needed a workshop, they would get a professional director and they would get professional actors. It was incredible. And it's something that the writer who did it immediately after me was Lisa McGee, you know. And so they were giving these opportunities to young writers who weren't tested. You know, who hadn't necessarily written anything. Like, I had not written a full-length play at that time. And I think that's something that I really see in theatre culture now. Yeah. Plays get dramaturged to death.
Yeah.
Writers aren't trusted for the most part. I know there are a few exceptions, but plays are sort of talked to death before they're allowed to be. And I think that that play came out of... again, in the same as Chris Hannon, you know, trusting a writer, trusting that if you take a writer seriously, if you give them the money, it was paid decently, and you had the resources, that the writer will rise to that. And that's where my first play came from.
I have friends who are playwrights, and I really do feel that the mentorship of young playwrights has really disappeared in a lot of arts, you know. It's a real shame.
And taking people, and also the thing about that residency was that you didn't have to write a play by the end of it. It was for you. If you did write a play, and even, you know, the National Theatre, I didn't think they ever imagined that they would write a play and it would be a debut play by a new young writer, or it doesn't even have to be young. I was young, but a new writer. But it was part of the commitment to the ecosystem that might not be the play that they would put on, but their hope was that would be a start, and maybe in a couple of plays' time, this writer is then writing a play that can go on those big stages.
It's something that's, I think, lacking a little bit, but I'm very glad that they brought Leaves out into the world, because actually it was a quite important play for me in college. And I think that the link sort of between stories and plays is when I see like a very good, like a really brilliant play, it feels like magic to me, in the same way that like a really brilliant story feels like, I read it and I'm like, I can't do that. I can't unpack it, or I can't unpack it in the same way like I can unpack a novel or try and understand it. Like, it feels like something, like there's a force or something behind it. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And again, you know, it's very easy to write a mediocre story. It's very easy to write a competent story. Very, very hard to write a story that works. You know, in theatre, there's nothing... One of the things that's so brutal about theatre is there's nothing worse than sitting in a play that isn't working.
Yeah.
You know?
And
you feel it as a writer. You know, you feel it as an audience member. Yeah. You feel the sort of... But when it's working, it's there's nothing like it. It's like a drug. And I think there is something, it's that magic of, I think, a short story that works, it changes you, it stays with you. There's something about the potency of it, maybe. I love Bruno Schultz. I was teaching Bruno Schultz recently, A Street of Crocodiles, and there was a lovely review just last week of a book about him in The Guardian, and it described his work as... it said his work is like a potent concentrate that most writers dilute to a sippable weakness. I thought that was a lovely description. There was something about, you know, the potency that you can get in a short story.
Just before we have to go, but Lucy, I do want to ask you about a very good short story, which is your short story, which won the National Short Story Award. And I just wanted to ask you about All the People Were Mean and Bad. Can you tell me about writing this story and where it came from and everything?
This was a story that I thought about for quite intensively for more than a year before writing it. And when I did write it, I wrote it in 2 days.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Doesn't always happen like that. Yeah. I have other stories that, you know, have taken sort of draft after painful draft for years. But sometimes what happens with a story is, always think a story comes from when you get several different things that spark each other, like Tinder. And maybe some of that is, you know, your own lived experience, and then something happens to ignite that and to turn it into fuel. And with this story, I was taking my daughter she was like a baby at the time, she was one. And there was a play group I was taking her to run by a local church that was a kind of a nice one to go to because they had good biscuits and they had like decent coffee and they had clean toys. These things matter. And because it was a church-run play group, stay and play, they had all of these like little board books for children about, you know, the Bible stories. And I was thinking how interesting it was that, thinking again back to fairy tales and those first stories that we encounter, you know, I was thinking about the myth of Noah's Ark and how all children really, you know, no matter if they're from one of the Abrahamic faiths or not, we know the story of Noah's Ark. You know, we know the animals going in two by two and the ark. And so many children's stories, you know, you get their arks and pairs of animals and they're kind of cute. But actually, it's such a terrifying narrative. You know, this narrative of this willful, capricious God who just decides all of you are, you know, smoted. And so it's kind of a terrifying story. And I was interested in, as I always am, in these grand narratives and the ways that we inculcate children into them and into the ways of the world and fairy tales. And that's kind of an abiding interest of mine. So I was thinking about this and I was thinking about how to have a story about that. Mm. And there is something of the sort of the Peter and Jane in it of the narrator in that story is mourning the loss of her childhood belief. She's grown up in a sort of evangelical home and she no longer, those narratives no longer serve her. They're no longer enough. And she's mourning their loss. And I didn't know. I thought and thought and thought and thought and thought. And I thought for about a year. And eventually I suddenly realised that the tone I was going for was one of elegy.
Yeah.
And it's an elegy because it starts off that story 2 weeks after your cousin dies. You're on a night flight back to London from Toronto. So the story is literally elegy in that it's returning from a funeral and a cousin has died. But it's also elegy in that it's about the loss of how far we've come from the place that we grew up. And it's about, you know, how far we've come from who we were and who we thought we'd be. How far we've come from the child we used to be and the things we now believe. You know, how far we've ended up from the sort of person we thought we were.
Yeah.
So it's about distances and it's about, and it's also about an elegy. It's an elegy for the people that we thought we could be and we are not. You know, the people that we will not be. So it's an elegy for all of the, and so as soon as I could hear, sometime, and quite often I work, I hear my story, you know, and I could hear the tone of it. And as soon as I could hear the tone, like the frequency that I needed to get, I was able to write this story. And I remember writing it, I remember the very specifically the days that I was writing it because my son was in reception. And so I went, so my daughter, I was writing the story. My husband was looking after my daughter in the morning. So I was writing and then he delivered her back at sort of midday. And then I wrote while she had her nap. And then we went to pick up my son from school. And I came back and I put them in front of the TV, which when they were that young, I tried not to do, but they were watching Dumbo, which was one of their favorite things at that time. And they didn't like it if I was out of the room. But if I was in the same room, they would sort of kind of tolerate it. And so I remember the sort of psychic energy that it took to stay on the frequency, on the tone of my story, kind of blocking out the children, blocking out Dumbo in the background. Maybe something of, you know, baby mine or whatever made it through. But I remember the psychic effort that it took to stay on the frequency of that story because I knew that if I left it, I might not be able to come back there the next morning. I might not be able to come back so easily.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I remember just this, all of my psychic creative energy was in, blocking out the children, like creating this bubble around myself and staying in the world and staying in the tone of this story. And very little change actually once I did that.
Yeah.
Between drafts.
I think our time is up, unfortunately, Lucy. That was absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. I feel like I've learned loads, actually. And now I want to write a story, which is not a feeling I've had for a while. thank you so much.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting, you know, and I think if you do have people listening, you know, go back and find something, like set yourself that task of like the Peter and Jane type challenge. I mean, Neve Pryor has done that. Yeah. she's you know, annoyingly, she's done it. She's done it really well. Yeah. But I think, you know, it's working with those, the limited, when you're trying to say something above and beyond the limitations of what you have, which is kind of the essential human condition, you know, trying to express things that are inexpressible, that are ineffable, that are ineluctable, with these paltry words that we have, and these words that trail the ghosts of all the ways that they've been used in the past, and these words that are insufficient. There's something, you know, going back to childhood, there's something there that's really fertile.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you, Lucy. And yes, that was the Singing Fly podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.